This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, it's our ongoing Science Cafe series in partnership with David Brooks of the Science Cafe Nashua. Today, a topic that gives many Americans sweaty palms: cancer screenings. For decades, we've been told early detection saves lives, and so legions of women faithfully schedule mammograms and men their PSA blood tests for prostate cancer. But in recent years, the science behind these tests has become clouded and controversial. More medical researchers are questioning the benefits of these early screenings, with some even saying they cause more harm than good. Today in The Exchange, we put these tests to the test, and let's hear from you. What's your experience? Do you feel that early screening saves lives, or does it, more often, lead to unnecessary treatment, anxiety, and suffering? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from Hanover, Dr. Gilbert Welch. He's a general internist at White River Junction's VA and a professor of medicine at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Dr. Welch's research has focused on overdiagnosis in cancer screening, which he addresses in his books, Should I Be Tested for Cancer?, and also his latest book, Overdiagnosed. Dr. Welch, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in studio, Dr. Jose Montero, Director of the Division of Public Health Services at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Dr. Montero, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And also with us, Dave Brooks, reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. He writes the Granite Geek column and moderates, as I said, the Science Cafe Nashua, a monthly series of conversations held in casual settings around the city. And Dave Brooks, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, Dave, just frame this for us. What was the big question you were trying to address late last fall at the Science Cafe Nashua?
Well, so the Science Cafe, as you said, the idea is to bring people together and discuss some issue with a few expert panelists and some beer and pub food. At we meet at Killarney's, by the way, in Nashua. And so the idea is to have something that people are thinking about and that we can provide some expert commentary on, the panelists can. And so obviously medical testing, medical screening was one that had come up a lot, and particularly for those of us who are over the age of 50 and find these things being waved in our face all the time whenever we go to the mail. So we had a couple people, including Dr. Montero, a couple of doctors come there and talk about it in the audience. About 50 people showed up, and most of them of, shall we say, my age group. And they all wanted to know, should I be tested? Really, they wanted most of them wanted a yes or no answer, or when should I be tested? What are the conditions? They wanted a black and white kind of prescription as to how to proceed, which is, I think, kind of the whole issue here, because this is turning out to not be something that has a black and white prescription.
Well, that's real interesting what you said, Dave. Talk a little bit more about these things being waved in our faces every time I open the mail. That's a key point.
Well, that's a little excessive, perhaps.
But I hear you. Get tested for this. Get tested for that.
Sure. And I, as you say, all my life I've kind of heard that is early detection saves lives. That sounds like a phrase that must have been in a PSA commercial on TV or something. And it's really, as a layman, it's only recently that I've heard the alternative. And I believe actually the medical profession, these guys can talk about it, have been debating this a lot longer. But it's sort of only percolated out to the general audience that sometimes early testing doesn't say lies, it causes more problems.
Well, and Dr. Welch, that's what your work has been about, and I definitely want to dive into that with you. But describe the emotions, Dr. Welch, around this, you know, the anxiety that people might understand intellectually, that, you know, they could be overdiagnosed, so to speak, as you say in the title of your book. But still, nobody wants to be that one person who, quote unquote, could have caught it early and survived.
Well, I think there's a lot about screening that's counterintuitive, and you might think that screening and early detection can only help, but of course it has both benefits and harms. And then you might think that all the survivors you see from breast and prostate cancer screening represent evidence of its benefit, when in fact it's more likely to represent evidence of its harm, people who were diagnosed unnecessarily. So there's a lot of counterintuitive features of screening. Ironically, one of the fastest ways to be diagnosed with cancer is to be screened for it. So it is a very challenging issue for people, in part because our concept of cancer is oversimplified, and we're beginning to really have a different understanding of cancer in the medical profession. And it's important, I think, for the general public now to have a feel for that.
Well, and key in on that, if you could, please, because the word cancer does, understandably, myself included, it flips people out. You always think it's bad. You always think it's a possible death sentence. And yet you've written, Dr. Welch, that there are lots of cancers that, you know, really aren't going to hurt you.
Yeah, and I'm going to fall back on what's been called the barnyard pen of cancers. This is not my language. It probably dates from almost 50 years ago. But this barnyard pen includes the birds, the rabbits, and the turtles. And the goal is not to let any of the animals escape the pen to become deadly. Now, the birds are the most aggressive cancers. They're the ones that have already spread by the time they can be detected. These are really bad cancers. And early detection doesn't help because the birds are already gone. The rabbits are hopping around. You might catch them if you build enough fences. They are the cancers that may be helped by early detection. And then there are the turtles, the cancers that aren't going anywhere anyway. Screening finds lots of turtles. And the problem is that you never want to be treated for a cancer that's not destined to ever bother you. So there's this heterogeneity, birds, rabbits, and turtles. And unfortunately, screening is best at finding the turtle.
Well, and I want to get Dr. Montero in, but you piqued my interest, Dr. Welch. So just give us an example or two of each. What kind of cancer is a bird, for example?
Well, by the way, all these animals exist within a same set of cancers. So there are breast cancers that are birds, there are breast cancers that are rabbits, and there are breast cancers that are turtles. Same with prostate cancer. There are prostate cancers that are birds, and there are prostate cancers that are rabbits, and there are a lot of prostate cancer turtles.
I see.
So this heterogeneity exists within all of the cancers, even lung cancer. And we're just beginning to appreciate that the pathologic diagnosis of cancer includes a wide variety of abnormalities, some of which will rapidly progress and can't be found early because they've already spread, some of which are more slowly progressive, and some of which are not progressing at all and may even go away.
Well, Dr. Montero, to bring you in, too, and this is as a public health professional, you know, that mantra, early detection saves lives. It does seem like there's more researchers these days saying maybe yes, maybe not. How do you, as a public health professional, communicate this more nuanced message?
It has always been incredibly tricky because for us as a public health agency at the Department of Health, we have the overview of the whole population. We don't treat individuals. We look at what we can do to improve health for the whole population in New Hampshire. And that comes to sometimes simplified recommendations that do not necessarily apply to some particular sets of circumstances. But the reality is that that is what happens with any clinical guidelines as well. When we look at, okay, go and get every woman over 50, get a mammogram every year, every 2 years, every 5 years, whatever the current recommendation can be, because they do change, that doesn't include people who has specific different levels of risks. And as Dr. Welch was saying, there is a huge heterogeneity between each type of cancer. The other thing is that we emphasize as an agency some particular types of cancers for which we have clear preventive efforts or where early detection has clear benefits. That's why we work in colorectal, breast, and cervical cancer. And we are not in the field of thyroid cancer. Certainly, we are working in prevention and education around prevention of melanoma. But we emphasize a lot of things in the prevention arena as we emphasize the early detection. But cancer has this place in society that is so incredibly complex. We use terminology that we don't use for anything else. We become cancer survivors. It doesn't matter if you have an aggressive or a mild cancer. It doesn't matter if you have a cancer that progresses or a really deadly type of cancer. But we don't use the same terminology for stroke. We don't use the same terminology for heart attacks. You don't hear people saying, oh, I am a heart attack survivor, and get from the surrounding community the support and the emotion that a cancer diagnosis brings. So anything that we do needs to have that context for us to be able to successfully implement any measures or any recommendations. And unfortunately, there are not black and white answers. There aren't. And we as a society and as a public expect those. And you said something about the science being reevaluated. I think that the science continues to be the same. What we are finally getting to change is the way that we interpret it. We want black and white answers. We are realizing that science wasn't giving those to us, and we are trying to figure out how to better explain to people what risk is and how to read those numbers. Dr. Welsh has done great presentations before where he explains the difference in risk and assessments, and we try to explain that message to the general public, but it is not an easy task.
Well, and speaking of this evolving message in the science, another thing, Dave Brooks, that has changed is the technology that we have. You know, 25 years ago, you could maybe detect some of this. Now, the screening mechanisms themselves have gotten much more high-tech, and they can see all sorts of stuff.
Absolutely, which just raises the possibility of false negatives or finding turtles. A metaphor I hadn't heard before. That's a great one. I'm scribbling notes, frankly, as he was talking. And frankly, there's one other aspect of this that I think clouds it up, at least from the doctor's point of view, is that it's taken so long for us to get the message to go to your doctor and check and find stuff, is that even when it's not involved a cancer test, there are benefits to going to your doctor regularly and having checkups. And cancer, the scary cancer test, is one of the things that has brought, and if I may sort of gender stereotype, particularly males who otherwise wouldn't go to the doctor if you dragged them, well, they'll go because they may be afraid of cancer. And so you get them to the doctor, and so they have other health benefits. So that's one aspect that complicates it even further.
All right. Well, a lot more conversation and a lot more questions coming up. We'll start to dive into some of the evolving recommendations surrounding mammograms and that PSA prostate cancer test. We'll take your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about early screening tests for cancer, especially breast and prostate cancer. It's part of our ongoing Science Cafe conversations in partnership with David Brooks of the Science Cafe Nashua. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What's your experience with this issue? What questions do you have? Do you feel that early screening does indeed save lives, as we're so often told? Or can it, at times, lead to unnecessary treatment, suffering, anxiety? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dr. Jose Montero is with us, Director of the Division of Public Health Services at the New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Gilbert Welch, an internist at White River Junction VA and a professor of medicine at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. And Dave Brooks, reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. He writes the Granite Geek column and, as I said, moderates the Science Cafe Nashua. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Tanya joins us from Bedford. Hi, Tanya. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I had one of those really special milestone birthdays this summer. So as a result, I am going for my first screening colonoscopy this Friday.
Happy 50th birthday, Tanya.
We say Hawaii, Laura.
Okay.
You know, 5-0.
Got it.
I know there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about colonoscopies, and for folks who don't have a strong family history or who are not having problems, there's been talk that maybe occult blood might be a good screening that's not as invasive. And I mentioned this to my doctor, and he's like, no way, no how, you're going for the colonoscopy.
Well, and Tanya, good luck with that, by the way.
Thank you.
What do you think, Dr. Welch, the dreaded colonoscopy?
Well, first, I don't think it should be as dreaded. I'll be honest. I had one at age 50. My father died of colon cancer at age 60, so I thought that cancer I would take a look at. Tanya's absolutely right. The question of colonoscopy versus fecal occult blood is actually a very open one. And in fact, I'm quite proud to say the White River Junction VA is heading up, is the coordinating center for a major randomized trial of just that question. It will involve 50,000 people, 50,000 veterans across the United States, enrolled in a trial of the annual fecal occult blood testing, the simple, cheap test versus a screening colonoscopy. It is an open question, which is the better test.
Okay. Well, what would you – so Tanya, she should look at that. I mean, I know you can't advise
it's
people on the air, Dr. Welch, but yeah.
No, it's definitely an option, and it's a very viable option.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Tanya. Dave Brooks, go ahead.
Well, at Science Cafe, the colonoscopy was the one test that all the doctors were widely in favor of, as I recall, because it can treat as well as – detect.
Well, and that's interesting because the other test, though, on the other side of that spectrum, I'm guessing, Dave, is the PSA blood test for prostate cancer, right? I mean, you've written about this. This is a test that has a lot of questions around it.
Oh, absolutely. That one, that's the most uncertain of all of the ones that we deal with generally.
Yeah, and Dr. Montero, can you talk about the PSA blood test for prostate cancer? Because having done the reading yesterday, I almost walked away feeling like, why would anybody bother having this test? It seems like its rate of false positives is super high. Its rate of false negatives is high. Why bother?
And that's the question. Why bother? And there are many different approaches to how to interpret and look at PSAs, and that's one of the big problems that we have with national recommendations for the general populations. There are many groups that have recommendations that contradict each other. In general, in the public sector, in the public health sector and national recommendations, we follow the national standards from the United States Preventive Services Task Force that brings people from many different disciplines. And when you look at the data and you analyze the results, it really doesn't offer any advantage as a generally recommended measure for the whole population. But I know that there are groups in urology that will recommend that and have a base level because you will never know how it will increase later on.
So consider it a base level for comparative purposes instead of this is, yes, you have cancer, no, you don't.
Yeah, that's the recommendation. But the reality is that the wide literature doesn't support that approach. And actually, some people may believe that it builds into that perception of get something done today because you never know. And that creates a perception that you're going to really prevent, that an early diagnosis is going to change your outcomes. And what we need is a better test that identifies the real risk of those prostate cancers that will progress. We are not there yet, but the uncertainty on that has been incredible. But then, because we are making all of these tests, a huge cottage industry has grown around that because now you do the test, you do the surgery, and we have great surgical capacities and robotic capacities that may decrease complications. Then you build more machines.
And we have
a huge infrastructure to manage and treat a condition that a lot of people, removing the emotion that the word cancer brings in, will tell you that maybe we are not doing the right things for most people.
Yeah, having read this again, it's pretty profound, Dr. Montero, that there is this whole industry around treating people, sometimes painfully, sometimes with terrible side effects, for something that probably wouldn't hurt them.
We know, and now medical science has changed, and we have improved treatments, and we have improved diagnostic capacities. So people who used to die before with these cancers, today we can save them. What we need to figure out is how to do early detection at a stage that is good for them to be detected and we can treat them and not detect the people who is never going to progress or know that they are not going to progress and even knowing don't do much with them. We are not there yet. But we as a society have a hard time accepting those things. And any discussion around that becomes highly politicized and incredibly emotional.
And the whole fear around the word cancer and so forth that we talked about earlier. Go ahead, Dr. Welch.
Yeah, I was just going to say we've sort of been operating on a worldview that the goal is to find as many cancers as possible. And it was really prostate cancer screening that demonstrated to us that's the wrong approach, that, you know, we can't always be looking for more and more cancer because the harder we look, we always find more. And prostate cancer is the poster child for the problem of overdiagnosis because once men get over age 60, about half of them will have pathologic evidence of the disease. So we need to change our mindset from always thinking earlier is always better, because earlier is always better always leads us to find more and more and more. And the question now is, you know, how early? And how do we find not the most cancers, but how do we find the cancers that are going to matter? And that turns out to be a much more challenging issue.
Well, and again, the number 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Salvella joins us now by phone. He's an internist with Southern New Hampshire Health Services. And Dr. Vella, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Well, we've been talking about this issue again of cancer screening, how much is too much, whether we overdiagnose cancer. I wonder what sorts of questions and fears you hear from your patients, Dr. Vella.
That's a good question. And I joined a little bit late, but I heard the last few minutes. Most people that come in, if you're a male and you're over 50, the expectations are sort of, it's time to have my prostate checked. I've heard about this my whole life. Should I get my prostate checked? That's probably the first thing that I hear and the thing that I hear most commonly.
And what do you tell people when they say, hey, doc, should I have this PSA test? What do you say?
That opens up a can of worms for sure.
Yeah.
What I try to say is that we don't know if you're going to die with that cancer or from that cancer. I use the same kind of discussion as the previous physician was speaking about. I think it was Dr. Welch. If you live long enough, you're going to get prostate cancer. Usually you die of something else first.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's not a message that you typically get, is it?
No.
You know, looking at the recommendations of the major medical groups on this PSA test for prostate cancer, the American Urological Association, the American Cancer Society, the CDC, all these groups that people look to for guidance say men should discuss it with their doctors, basically. You know, I wonder, Dr. Vella, are they kind of punting? I mean, why can't these groups that are so respected and are supposed to know, why can't they be more clear on this?
Great question. I ask myself that question every day.
Yeah, help me out, right?
Well, first of all, the studies aren't perfect. If you look at the PLCO study, the one that was done in the United States, and then the European study, those studies were flawed, and they did show some benefit, and people take different information away from that. And as you know, as you pointed out, there are different recommendations by the United States Task Force, by the Cancer Society, by the College of Physicians, and the urologists. They're all a little bit different, but all of them do say talk to your doctor. So it puts us in a tough spot.
It absolutely does. So how do you wade through that, Dr. Vella?
Well, I try to go through it, and as I said, I don't know if you're going to die with it or from it. There are ways to screen you for prostate cancer, and I kind of go through the pathway of if we screen you and you have a positive diagnosis, and this is how it would be treated, and if we don't screen you, then we don't worry about it. And I kind of go down that pathway.
Is anybody willing, given the fear surrounding the word cancer, is anybody willing to say, nah, I don't need to know?
There are plenty of men who say, you don't need to do that test to me? Well, that's good. and I'm not going to worry about it anyway. There are several people that say that.
Given their profile, given their history and so forth?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Dr. Vella, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Dr. Sal Vella again. He's in practice in southern New Hampshire. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Welch, I heard you wanted to jump in there for a moment.
Well, I just wanted to weigh in on why the recommendations are to see your doctor, to talk to your doctor, because ultimately this isn't just about science. It's also about value judgments. And that's really hard to make recommendations that involve value judgments because there are these two sides to screening. It can help some, but it always hurts others. And I think this is something that both breast and prostate cancer screening have in common. There's uncertainty about the benefits. Some randomized trials show benefit for the test. Some show that there's none. I believe they do have a beneficial effect, but it's very small. It's on the order of less than 1 per 1,000 screened for 10 years avoids a cancer death, either a prostate or breast cancer death. And the medical care system is traditionally focused on that one person, but I've always said, well, geez, it's also important what happens to the other 999. And for both these two tests, there are very real harms, and they're the harms of false alarms and the harms of overdiagnosis. And how you weigh this fact that some may be helped while others are harmed, and it's going to be more people who are harmed, although the harms are arguably less important than the benefits. Boy, that's a value judgment.
Yeah, it's hard. Mm-hmm. Well, and just real quickly, and then we've got tons of people who want to jump in. Dr. Welch, you know, false alarms, a lot of people listening may say, okay, I can put up with the stress and anxiety of waiting for some results, over a couple weeks. But what are some of the more serious impacts of what you call overdiagnosis besides, the stress and anxiety?
Before we just go so quickly over false alarms, I think it is important to talk about false alarms, particularly in breast cancer screening, because it's the poster child for the problem. In this country, during a 10-year course of annual screening, around half of women will be called back for a worrisome mammogram. And I think we've almost made a worrisome mammogram a rite of passage for middle-aged American women. Now, she may only need another view, she may need an ultrasound or an MRI, or she may undergo a biopsy, all of which can ultimately cost patients real money as we have more and more out-of-pocket costs. Now, how much of a harm that is clearly a value judgment, but my value judgment is that any screening program that alarms half the population is kind of outrageous. No European country would tolerate it, and I would think the public health community would worry about that because all that anxiety can't be good for human health.
Let's go back to our listeners, and Marlene's waiting in Hinsdale. Hi, Marlene. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I am definitely in favor of early screening for breast cancer. I had my routine mammogram last February and was diagnosed March 5th with cancer of my left breast. Had the MRI test and decided there were two more spots that needed either a biopsy or I could just go ahead and have a mastectomy, which I did do. And at the time of surgery, dye was injected into my breast also, and the cancer, they already knew that the cancer had moved out of the duct and into the breast tissue surrounding the duct, and the cancer had moved into the lymph nodes in my arm. Cancer cells, no tumors, but if it had not been for that test, that mammogram, I would not have known, and even when the doctor examined me before I had the mastectomy, he couldn't find or feel anything. It would not have been found by feeling.
Yeah, it was not a lump that made you go in and get that mammogram. Was it part of your routine, Marlene?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, glad you came out okay, and thank you for calling in. And, Dr. Montero, these are the stories that, make women show up faithfully every year. I mean, I do it, and I'm very familiar with the fact that half of women will be called back for a worrisome result. And yet, you hear stories like Marlene, you say, darn it, I'm getting the mammogram.
But you see, she's talking about doing her mammogram as part of a regular routine, and I don't need to know the age, but We have recommendations for particular age groups above 50 right now, but there are other groups that advocate to do it from 40. And you may remember how politicized this discussion became a couple of years ago in Congress, even creating a special group that has to approve national recommendations for breast cancer. That's the emotional part of it. I do believe that there is a lot of people that benefits from having the mammography, the mammograms done at the right time, as we recommend. And we need to figure out a way to improve that recommendation and add specifics for some groups that have higher level of risk. The problems that we have is that we try to cover everybody with just one blank recommendation. And you start to hear the technology groups and the technology and the industry to come and tell you, well, actually, you have to do this. And you need to add an ultrasound of them. And then you have this dense breast issue, and then you actually have to change to MRIs. And now you actually need to do 3D mammograms for everybody. We lose perception of risk and benefit. Most people will benefit. Most women will benefit from the mammogram over 50. It will be great if we can better target that recommendation for even people over 50 that has lower level of risk to the general population, but certainly to people under 50 that has clear genetic, ethnic, or family history of breast cancer that require a different type of recommendation.
So be a little more selective, Dr. Montero, than just saying everybody go out and do this all the time.
And that's where the beauty of talking to your doctor really applies. Now, I know that we put the doctors in a really tough place because we are giving them five pockets of options to choose from at the same time that we, as a society, all want the rapid answer, immediate answer, and final black and white answer that does not exist.
And Dave, real quick, Dr. Montero has touched on this a couple times, there is a financial component to this. There is, as he said, a whole cottage industry surrounding testing and follow-ups and procedures and so forth.
There's obviously a lot of money, and as you said, you follow the money, and that explains a lot of what we do, and it has been one of the major drivers for healthcare costs going up. And it leads to one of the issues here, which is trying to measure trying to provide a good metric for healthcare. So dollars is one metric and success rate is another, but you don't get a success rate metric from not doing something. You'll see stories in the paper about, cancer survivors, to use the terms you noted, the way I've written them, but you don't see stories in the paper about a person who didn't have inappropriate treatment because they didn't get tested and they didn't spend the money. It's much harder to measure that and to see it, see that benefit.
Marlene, good to hear your story. And we'll hear from you after a short break, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, political junkie Ken Rudin talks about the new Congress and a growing roster of presidential hopefuls. Email us your questions for Ken before the program to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. And again, join us for political junkie Ken Rudin tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the tough question of, do frequent cancer screenings save lives or provoke fear and unnecessary treatment? How much is too much when it comes to cancer screenings? Join us, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dr. Welch, Dr. Montero, Dave Brooks, let's go right back to our listeners. Bill's in Penacook. Hi, Bill. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, my primary care doctor started testing my PSA when I turned 50, and after about 5 years, between 2005 and 2006, my PSA went up 1.4 year over year, and he said, you should go see a urologist and have a biopsy, which I did. It turned out it was Gleason 8. Prostate cancer. I had no symptoms. I had surgery, and I have undetectable PSA since. So if it wasn't for PSA testing, today I would either be struggling with metastatic prostate cancer or I would be dead. So I'm an advocate of yearly PSA testing.
Well, and Bill, thank you very much for calling in. And Dr. Welch, the last two callers have said if it wasn't for, in Bill's case, PSA testing, in Marlene's case, that mammogram. So I just wonder what you say to those folks. They feel very thankful for these tests.
Sure. And I think, you know, I really don't even like answering this question, but I've got to say what I believe to be really important for the public to understand. Survivor stories are particularly misleading. We always interpret them as evidence that the test did some good. I hope both Bill and Marlene were, in fact, helped by the test. And I hate to have to say this, though, but there are other possibilities. One possibility is they could have been treated just as well when they appeared clinically. And by the way, one of the things we should really be clear about is some of the success story in breast cancer. And the big success story in breast cancer is better treatment. And treatment is much better now than it would have been 20 or 30 years ago. And we should all feel good about that. Treatment is really important.
So increased breast cancer survivor rates are due to better treatment, not more screening.
But we shouldn't be talking about survivor rates, because the way to get a lot of survivors is just to diagnose a lot of patients. It's the mortality rate. The death rate from breast cancer is down about 30%. That is great news over the last 20 years or so. And that's largely about better treatment. Everyone agrees that treatment has improved markedly. But anyway, I want to come back to the survivor stories and how we interpret them.
Sure.
So the other possibility is, one, that people would do just as well when they were diagnosed clinically. And then the other possibility is that they were overdiagnosed. So they might have been helped, they might have been overdiagnosed, or they might have just been found earlier and not had any change in their outcome. And I know that complexity is unpleasant, but the way to learn about the benefits of screening is not by listening to individual survivor stories. The way to learn about the effects of screening is through randomized trials, and that's, of course, what we've done. And quite frankly, the randomized trials produce a mixture of results. As I said early on, my belief is it does help a few individuals, but it does lead many others to go through a lot of things that they otherwise wouldn't. And that's why I'd say screening is a choice. It's not a public health imperative.
Dr. Montero, that leads right into you. Screening is a choice, not a public health imperative. Are there cases where you feel like it is a public health imperative with certain types of cancers that are aggressive, that are known to, you know, really get to people if they're not caught early?
The history of cancer in the last 50 years has dramatically changed in many different ways. We have seen dramatic increases in the prevalence of the disease, basically because we have new risks that we didn't have before, maybe in the environment, maybe in the way that we are aging, maybe in the way that we eat, the medications that we use, the exposures that we have. So it may be that we are at a point in our society where we have a higher risk of cancer. Treatment has improved dramatically. 50 years ago, you get a diagnosis, you died, end of the story. Today, that's not the case, and that continues to get better and better. When we look at those two things combined, the increase in risk and the increase in prevalence and the increase in treatment opportunities, certainly when I look at a population, I want to be able to diagnose them at a state where treatment really will have an impact. We can do that in two ways: wait for the disease to manifest itself, or in cases where we know that we have good strategies that are good in a population base, to use them. And that's why we, as a state agency, and looking at this as a population health component, clearly believe that doing screenings for some populations in breast cancer, colorectal cancer, makes sense and adds a benefit to the health of the population. I don't want to be diagnosing everybody when they are stage 4. Certainly, I don't want to be diagnosing preclinic stuff that is not going to impact quality of life or life survival for any person. Finding that fine line, that point, that inflection point, is tricky. We don't have the elements, we don't have all of the metrics, and we don't have all of the technology that we should have. But it would be great if someday we can just go and look at breast cancer and said, all women with this ethnic or genetic makeup, all Ashkenazi Jewish women that didn't have babies before 35 and target those groups, that will be beautiful. We are not there yet.
And you do hear some of that. And I think the key word there then, Dr. Montero, is some populations, instead of this sort of everybody over 40 or everybody over 50 go get this?
At this stage, we are segmenting populations. We are not saying everybody. We are saying people over 50. And by that, we are already segmenting the population.
But that was controversial when that happened.
It is, and it will continue to be. And certainly, I hope that as science progresses and new technologies are out there and we have better management of the data and re-educate the public, we can change that recommendation. I don't think that every woman over 50 should have the amount of mammographies that we do. But how do we select those that need it? We don't know yet.
Dave Brooks, real quick, and then back to our listeners.
Real quick, I think we've seen here a perfect example of anecdote versus data. The story from a single person will overwhelm most of us as compared to 5,000 randomized trials. And I think that you see it all the time in lots of issues, lots of public policy issues, public health issues.
Sure.
There's a reason why newspaper stories start with an anecdote most of the time. And it's hard to get beyond that.
Well, sure, an anecdote has a family and a face and a community tie, and it's heartbreaking or heartwarming depending on the outcome. A randomized test is, you know, pardon me, Dr. Welch, but someone, you know, at Dartmouth just saying, here's my randomized test results. It's not as compelling.
It's right. And Laura, I do want to just bring up one inconvenient truth, though. And this is about when Jose brought up our desire to, you know, not find people at stage four. And just so the audience knows, this is people who present with metastatic cancer. And I did a study with a colleague at the Oregon Health Sciences University that came out in the New England Journal about 2 years ago, showing over 30 years, the rate at which women present with metastatic breast cancer has remained unchanged despite the advent of screening mammography. Now, that's not the mammogram's fault. That's the bird's fault. That comes back to the heterogeneity of cancer. There are some very bad cancers out there. They're few. And those cancers are not even able to be detected, or by the time they're detectable, they're already metastatic. And we need to understand that there will always be some bad cancers, and the issue is less about early detection and more about can we treat them.
Let's go to Eleanor in Pittsfield. Hi, Eleanor. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I have went for a mammogram a few weeks ago, and I've already had an operation on a breast and on the same breast, and they found calcifications. There are cancers that go away, and from what I've heard, the calcifications, they wanted to do a biopsy from the calcifications. Could be or could not be anything, and you know, 80% or 90% or not, but the 10% could become cancer. So what do you do? I don't want to do another mammogram. I think radiation causes it. It's supposed to cure. It's supposed to detect, and then it causes cancer. So what do you, you know, are there there are cancers out there that really aren't you don't have to worry about, right?
Yeah, Eleanor, and we've definitely been talking about that. And you know, you're raising a question that I wanted to ask Dr. Welch, actually. What about the radiation involved in mammograms? The PSA blood test, I'm guessing there's no radiation involved. It's a blood test. But what about the radiation? Is there some danger from that?
Well, you like to ask me the questions I don't want to answer.
just do my job, Dr. Welch.
The party line is that the radiation, first, radiation and mammography was a bigger problem when it first came on. The federal government was very interested in that problem, trying to minimize radiation. Everyone understands the importance of minimizing radiation. The reality is it's very hard for us to know the effects, because if they are effects, they're very small. I do not think radiation is the biggest harm of mammography. I think overdiagnosis is the biggest harm of mammography. And it's that small calcification that the listener was the caller was just talking about, is the other edge. We were talking about stage four. That's the stage zero. That's the ductal carcinoma in situ, the microscopic form of cancer that was never found until, or largely was never even recognized to exist until there was mammography. And that's one of the side effects of looking early. Whenever you look harder, you find more, and that involves more people, and that leads to more treatment, and that can lead to more problems.
Well,
and that,
yeah.
That's what makes it a tough, very tough balance.
And when you have those calcifications that present, they do say to you, as Eleanor told us, it's probably not a problem, but just in case, in 10% of the cases, it is a problem. And then you're sort of stuck. You're like, well, what do I do? I don't want to be that one person, you know?
Right.
All right. Well, thank you, Eleanor. Good luck. Here's a couple emails that have come in, gentlemen. Here's one from Kathy in Mount Vernon. She says, how much influence does our health insurance coverage have in determining what cancer screening / tests are suggested, such as a colonoscopy? For example, the doctor who suggested that the fecal blood test might be enough to detect colon cancer, is that because it is cheaper than the colonoscopy and hence insurance companies will cover that instead? In other words, how many and what screenings will honestly be insurance-driven? And if insurance is determining the patient's fate, how can the patient be secure in knowing if the doctor is looking out for that patient's best interest? Boy, Dr. Montero, can I throw this to you? You know, she raises a great point. If there's a cheaper screening, but it's not necessarily a better screening, how should we as a patient feel about that?
This is a really good question. And as Dr. Welch said, those are the questions that sometimes we don't want to answer. So there are many different things in that question. First, we need to remember that with the advent of healthcare reform, preventive measures that are recommended by the USPS, by the United States Preventive Services Task Force, are free to the patient, so they don't have to pay for it.
So we're going to see more of these screenings.
So it doesn't
less.
Matter if it is the colonoscopy, or if it's the blood test, or if it is the blood test, the test in stools. So any one of those measures is recommended, so it should be covered. Now, the problems that we face is that they cover for the groups for whom the recommendation does exist, but that doesn't allow those others that may have some risk history that we would like them to get tested to be tested. So I don't think that the decision here is if this test is cheaper. Of course, when we look at the economics and the dramatic increases in cost in American healthcare, anything that we can do to save money with the same and obtain same or better outcomes, I am all for it. So it's not a bad thing to save money if we maintain people healthy or get to the same level of diagnosis. With the colonoscopy and the new test, I am all for new tests that are not invasive. As any human being, we dislike profoundly getting probed.
Well, the colonoscopy means a day off of work, and there's a lot of prep involved. And
if we have a test that offers the same level of detection, that's great. And through that test, the test detects a particular group of people that requires a second test, fine. Then less people will be exposed to more things. So that's the economics of this. So a better test is better in general because it saves money, but that should not be the driver force.
Okay, Kathy, thanks for the email. Yeah, Dave Brooks and then Dr. Welch. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, another aspect of the money question is when you've spent money on equipment, you're a hospital or a medical provider, you need to use that equipment in order to recoup your investment. 3D mammography, which is an incredible technology, it has these screens that would make any computer geek envy, but they cost like $10,000 a piece. The screens, or at least they did, that was a year ago. Maybe they don't anymore. But so you've spent $10,000 on a screen. You need to do X number of screenings over the course of the year in order to balance out the numbers. That's a pressure. Now, you know, doctors are doctors, and they're not gonna do what's wrong for the patient. But still, that's part of the thinking.
Yeah, because you want your office full. You got this nice equipment. You might as well have folks in using it, even if it's finding stuff. Like one of our earlier callers said, may not even be a problem. Wow, big, thorny issue. Dr. Welch, go ahead, jump in.
Oh, I was just going to say it's ironic that screening is actually probably the best covered procedure in medical insurance plans. It's often first dollars, part of the Affordable Care Act. They're all free. And to me, it's ironic that that's totally free, but if you have a heart attack or a car accident and you really need acute medical care, you're going to pay. So I think it's kind of funny how we've given screening tests for the well such a high priority, particularly given two things. One, they have these mixtures of effect, and then second is it may draw people in not realizing that all the subsequent expenses of following up on abnormal tests, they'll be paying substantial funds out of pocket.
Interesting. So given the changes in healthcare, we're spending more on these upfront screenings when, in fact, the benefits are questionable and the follow-up could be expensive, Dr. Welch.
It could be and lead to serious out-of-pocket costs. And I think it's something that patients ought to know. All of a sudden they may be involved in quite a lot of subsequent testing.
Okay, well, all of you, very interesting, a lot to think about. I want to thank you all very much for being here. Dr. Welch, thanks for your time. It was great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you.
That's Dr. Gilbert Welch, general internist at White River Junction VA, a professor at the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. His latest book is called Overdiagnosed. Dr. Montero, it's good to see you. See you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Jose Montero, director of the Division of Public Health Services here in the Granite State. And Dave Brooks, thanks for your time. We'll see you soon.
You bet.
That's Dave Brooks, reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. He writes the Granite Geek column and moderates the Science Cafe Nashua and helps us out with the Science Cafe here on The Exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Faith Meixel. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.